Thank you very much. And I think we'll pick up on that magical money point and take it from there. We are operating in a world of radical uncertainty. And I think market participants have been comforted by extreme policy support, which I think has left us uncomfortably detached from the world around us. And a man to put it in perspective, I'm really pleased to say, joins us right now. It's Bob Prince, the co-CIO of Bridgewater. Bob, fantastic to have you with us at this conference, sir. Thank you. 6 months ago, and I think 6 months ago feels like an absolute lifetime for you and me, but we were in the mountains of Davos, Switzerland. And as you know, the people that attend that conference are often detached from the world around us. You said something to me that just woke me up and everyone else listening. You said, the boom and bust cycle, as we know it, is over. A couple of months later, I just wonder how you reflected on those comments and whether the policy response really summarized what you were getting at. What are your thoughts on that, Bob? The policy regime we're in right now.
Well, we've certainly transitioned to a new policy, monetary policy regime. And the nature of this cycle is radically different. Even without it, I think we would have been in a different kind of a monetary and business cycle regime. I think the unfortunate thing is at the time, I don't think any of us were talking about the virus. But, you know, when I just to focus in on kind of where we are now and how that monetary policy cycle fits in, I think there are really three key elements to the current set of circumstances. We have a collapse in global income caused by a pandemic with interest rates at zero. And pretty much everything follows from that. This is very much different than a typical economic cycle because a typical economic cycle is a contraction in credit brought about by a tightening of monetary policy or fiscal policy, which is largely under the control of the central bank. And when things get bad enough, they cut interest rates, they ease monetary policy, and you come back out of it with an expansion of credit. What's happening this time is that we have the collapse in income. The causal influence is the virus. It's the pandemic. And it's the fear of safety. It's basically people staying home and not producing things that's caused a collapse in income, and the collapse in income causes a collapse in spending. So whereas normally you have monetary policy leading that tightening, credit falling, spending falling, and then income being the last thing to fall. In this case, income is the first thing to fall, which is causing a reduction in spending and then all the reactions to that. The driving influence is the virus, which nobody really understands very well, let alone the government responses to the virus, and then the responses of the public to the governments, and very big differences across countries. So there's a huge amount of uncertainty related to the virus as a causal influence. And then to pull out of this, you have zero interest rates. You're also going into this accumulating credit as opposed to reducing credit. So normally in an economic contraction, you're reducing credit, raising interest rates, which gives you a lot of room to cut interest rates and expand credit coming out. In this case, we have zero interest rates, you can't cut them, and credit is expanding, which reduces the potential to pull out of it. So the solution to that problem is actually appropriate, and it's what we refer to as monetary policy three or MP3. Monetary policy one is really an interest rate driven monetary policy. That's pretty much come to an end when you hit zero. Monetary policy two was the QE driven monetary policy post 2008, where you just buy the assets. But when the risk premiums are already low, there's a lot less potential for that. Monetary policy three is where we are now. And MP3 is the coordination of fiscal policy with monetary policy, where really the biggest actor is the fiscal stimulation, where you can direct the funds to the parts of the economy that most need it. But you support that with monetary policy and the printing of money to buy those bonds so that the interest rates don't go up and reverse the effects that you're trying to achieve. So that's a direct reflection of the fact that we're at zero interest rates, income and income levels are depressed. The actions to date are roughly appropriate. In other words, the amount of printing and the amount of fiscal stimulation has been roughly sufficient to fill the hole in incomes that was created. But not all of that money is getting spent. let's say 50 cents on the dollar that the government is sending out is actually getting spent. And so actually you haven't had nearly as much of a improvement in spending in the economy as you've had in the liquidity in the system. In addition, the central bank is printing money over and above what it takes to finance those deficits and sending that into all kinds of assets. And so we have a major reflation going on, which has been by and large successful so far. The big question about that is that while we're used to thinking in terms of growth rates, which is changes in output over short periods of time, the big thing that's happening now to be thinking about is the collapse in income and the level of income that exists. Because the low level of income that exists will be with us for a while in some substantial degree, which means lower profits, lower spending, and so forth. What also means lower cash flow. And for those that are in, kind of treading on thin ice with respect to their financial position, the longer that this goes on, the more difficult it becomes for them. And so you have these two pressures really operating at the same time. You have the collapse in income, which is collapsing cash flows, which will affect those that are most vulnerable to the collapse in cash flows. And you have the expansion of liquidity by the central bank going into assets, but may not be sufficient to cover those cash flows. And the programs to date are by and large sufficient to cover the income gap for about 3 or 4 months, starting from April. So we're really talking about an amount of money that gets you through the summer. And the problem then is that we're talking about the virus, which has a time frame of probably 18 to 24 months. And so I refer to that as a duration mismatch. Essentially, the time frame of the virus impact on spending and income in relation to the time frame of how long people can last financially.
So as you point out, we've got a duration mismatch. Though, as you can see up until today with markets down aggressively, we've had a huge rebound because markets are focused on the liquidity side of the equation, not on the cash flows. Are you saying, Bob, are you anticipating that in the next 3 months, as this Band-Aid that was put on a couple of months ago starts to wear off, that we could hit another air pocket?
Well, you're just going to see an instant replay. Every 3 or 4 months, you'll get the instant replay until governments run out of either the willingness or the ability to cover that gap. And so that becomes a very large uncertainty. And that's also different country by country. The United States is in the best position as a reserve currency, but your typical emerging economy can't necessarily go to the well over and over and over again. And so that also produces differentiation. So the divergent pressures between the income and cash flow to individuals, companies, and even countries, and the production of liquidity is a force that will create a lot of differentiation in outcomes. Your long duration assets, your storeholds of wealth benefit from the liquidity. But if you're a restaurant that can't get the next loan, right, or maybe you don't want the next loan, that liquidity may not help you. And so those companies and those individuals and those countries, which are most exposed to the cash flow impact, they're not storeholds of wealth. They don't get the liquidity. They suffer the most. And so that creates a differentiation of outcomes over time, which will be a really key element of what transpires in the next year or two. And from our standpoint, requires two things. A, it requires diversification. You don't want to be on the wrong side of that. And B, it presents alpha opportunities. If you can identify how those differential forces will play out.
Well, let's talk about the divergence right now and define what the wrong side of things actually is. Do you think the market's doing a decent job of discriminating and looking through the things that you identify?
Probably not good enough. I mean, you do see some differentiation, but if it's like 6-4, but the ultimate outcomes are like 8-2 or 10-0, then no, they're not. And so this is a very unique set of circumstances from a market standpoint, because normally we're all thinking about sort of, is the next move up, is the next move down, and that sort of thing. We're thinking in terms of growth rates. But, if you start from a 20% unemployment rate effectively, and you get a lot of growth and you go to a 15% unemployment rate, that's still a 15% unemployment rate. That's a massive shortage of income that's embedded in the system that you either have to allow to flow through the system or the government has to fill that hole. If you go back to the financial crisis in 2008, the peak unemployment rate was 10%. So if we bounce back from a 20 to a 10, we're just where we were in 2008. And then we're there without the ability to cut interest rates and move forward and having built up a lot of debts just to cover the income hole that we were in. So I think that the difference in the market, the way the markets will play out versus normal is this accumulation of a low level of income over a long period of time, which is a much different sort of grinding influence that almost can't be really discounted ahead of time effectively because you really don't know how long it's going to last. But the longer it lasts, that grinding effect of a lower level of income over a sustained period of time will gradually manifest itself on some parts of the economy in the world, while at the same time, the efforts to offset that with liquidity will benefit other parts of the, particularly the marketplace and to some extent the economy. I'll add one other thing to this, which is that at the end of the day, governments normally get what they want when they try hard enough. So we've gone back to 1800 and studied every financial panic and resulting deleverage or reflation. And in something like 115 out of 125 times across 39 countries, governments got what they wanted. But those getting what they wanted required choices. So, for example, you got four big ways to kind of untangle yourself from a mess. You've got an easy to monetary policy. You've got an easy to fiscal policy. You've got a debt restructuring, and you've got a currency devaluation. And so right now we have the first two. We have the easing of monetary policy and we have the fiscal policy. And it's, you know, an all-out effort on that basis. The question becomes, at what point is that enough? Or do we then transition to debt restructurings and currency devaluations? And from there, what is the status of the dollar as a reserve currency? And then from there, what is the storehold of wealth? And those are the big questions that we're really focused on right now. And also our clients are really thinking a lot about as well.
Bob, these are huge, huge issues. And for everyone tuning in right now, I think they want you to lift the lid on Bridgewater. What are you positioning for? With everything you've just said, all the risks surrounding that, what are you actually positioning for?
Well, I can't go into specific positions, of course, but I think there are really three big, we've got our normal processes assessing relative value and so on and so forth. And that's spread across a lot of different markets and, you know, very diversified in our positioning. But there are these three big forces will be relevant to probably everybody's positioning, but reflation, storehold of wealth, and differentiation. Those three themes are a good basis for thinking about how to structure a portfolio, whether it's for a strategic asset mix and a diversified asset mix that you hold, or whether it's for a sort of active tactical sort of trading. Reflation, what's a storehold of wealth, and differentiation of outcomes.
Can we talk about what a storehold of wealth is? I remember in January, Ray Dalio, your colleague, partner, and I'm sure good friend as well, made some headlines when he said cash is trash. Given where rates are right now, cash is looking pretty good. What is a storehold of wealth right now, Bob?
Sorry to interrupt you. I said he still says that. So almost every day. But so people typically think about cash as the risk-free asset. But when you're in a reflation, you can have a negative real return of cash, and it's not a good storehold of wealth. And so the types of things that you want to look to as a storehold of wealth are things that retain their value in real terms in such circumstances. And so, for example, you know, we talked about gold, obviously, but gold is just gold is just a contra current. It's really a currency. If you take the forward price of gold, it's just gold per dollar, you know, ounces per dollar, or dollars per ounce. And so gold is one of those, because the utility value of gold is higher, but it's because fiat money declines in value as you produce it. And so gold prices go up. It's mostly that the value of money is going down. And so the gold price is a metric for the value of money, mostly. But also you have other sources of storeholds of value. Let's say inflation index bonds are a really useful storehold of value because you get paid the inflation rate, right? We look at things like, certain types of equities. It's very interesting that, so long as the capitalist system is in place and we have, you know, free markets and economy and companies that operate as the distribution of resources, you have companies participating in that, in the economy, and certain types of companies have cash flow that actually puts them, establishes them as a form of a storehold of wealth. So for example, if you're owned a chain of movie theaters, that's not really a storehold of wealth because people don't have to go to a movie. But if you're talking about food, water, and basic healthcare, these things are necessary to physically live. They're physically necessary all around the world, everywhere. And so there are certain types of spending like that, that you can be assured that in 1, 5, 10, 20 years from now, people will buy food, they'll buy bread, they'll buy water, and they'll buy, you know, aspirin or whatever. So then the companies that provide that are in effect a form of a storehold of wealth. If you have certain kinds of technology companies that are at the sort of the vanguard of productivity, and they're the sources of productivity, sort of the fountain of innovation and productivity and economy, the duration of their cash flows will be much longer than a company that's got a very short duration of cash flows, and they'll be much more benefited by the liquidity production than the other types of companies that'll be hurt by the contraction in incomes. So, you know, these are the types of things that we look at as thinking about how do you think about a storehold of wealth over time.
Something I wanted to finish on, which I think is a really important theme for a lot of people right now. You mentioned free markets and capitalism. This doesn't feel like capitalism. I don't think we can pretend this is capitalism. The Federal Reserve seems to have lost faith in the capitalist system. I've asked President Bullard about this earlier this week. I'm just wondering from your perspective how things have changed now, from a market participant's perspective as well, where you can make the right macro call and then get the market call really, really wrong because you get slapped around the face by a policymaker that just has other ideas about what the price of something should be. How do you participate in a market quite like that one?
Well, you know, just like we talked about, the end of the boom bust cycle, as you know it, because of the nature of the dynamics has changed, that has progressed to what you're talking about, which is MP3 puts the government in the middle of the distribution of capital, right? So capitalism, as we know it, is the government steps back. Those who have savings or capital make decisions about where to send it on the basis of risk and return. And those who need it try to provide a good deal for that. And that provides for the distribution of resources. That's led to certain problems. Number one, it's led to over-leveraging, too much debt. It's led to income and wealth inequality, which is producing political conflict and so forth. So it's not solving all problems. It's a good system, but we're now in a difficult set of circumstances. And so now enter the government, where the government is now involved in making choices about where capital goes. And we can call it state capitalism. It's not like capitalism doesn't exist, but state capitalism, where it's there's a certain degree of directed capital. And I think an element of this is the too big to fail has broadened. It used to be that there was no such thing as too big to fail. We let Continental Bank just go down, right? There was no such thing as too big to fail. Then we realized, hold on a second, certain banks are too big to fail. Now we're at the point that certain companies are too big to fail. And so now the government is making choices about what's too big to fail, but they're doing it because they're making a choice pertaining to the populace. In other words, income inequality, people need jobs, you need to support your population. And so they're making very practical, a very practical evolution in capitalism to achieve what are their greater goals. Their greater goal is not that we have capitalism. Their greater goal is to have a healthy, quality public. And if you don't have a healthy, quality public where people have food and so forth, as a government, you'd better find a way to do that. Otherwise, you're going to be held accountable in one form or another. And so this transition to state capitalism is a practical response to that. It doesn't come without costs. In David Solomon's interview just before this, they were talking about that a little bit. And it doesn't come without costs, but what it does is it comes with choices. Because like I said, let's say you have a debt restructuring. Well, the person who held that debt is not coming out very well on that, right? But maybe the greater good is achieved according to the government. Or maybe you have a currency devaluation. Well, if you're holding that currency, you're not served by that. But maybe the greater good is served by that, according to somebody's judgment. So who is making the judgment is shifting to the government, because the government is ultimately accountable to the people, not to the investors. And so the investors, it's our job to just figure out what's going on there and stay safe and stay positioned for it. But I think in that world, you asked me, how do you deal with that from an investment standpoint?
Yeah.
You have to be able to track where the money goes. The world where you just, cut interest rates and now sort of figure out what the interest sensitive parts of the economy are, that world is gone. Now it's like, where's the money coming from and where's it going? How much is staying in the country? How much of it is leaving the country? What kind of companies is it going into? What kind of companies is it missing? And so on and so forth. And so you have to be able to track the money in order to have a chance to understand the markets and the differentiations and that are going to be occurring.
And Bob, I think what makes everyone uncomfortable is the government making a lot of those decisions for us. Bob, it's a conversation you and I have got to continue another time. Bob Prince, really appreciate your time at this conference. For Bloomberg Invest, Bob Prince there, the co-CIO of Bridgewater. I want